KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll screen Power of Community, How Cuba Survived Peak Oil on Thursday, August 8th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1990, Cuba's oil supply was cut by more than half. This film tells of the hardships and struggles, as well as the community and creativity of the Cuban people during this transition away from a highly mechanized agricultural system to one using organic methods of farming and local urban gardens. Again, that's How Cuba Survived Peak Oil, Thursday, August 8th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned, values-driven natural foods cooperative open daily from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., featuring farm-direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and a weekly farmer's market every Wednesday year-round. Located at Southeast Tibbetts Street and 21st Avenue in Portland for almost 50 years. Online at peoples.coop.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, this is Lane Ponce. I'm your fifth Monday host for Labor Radio. We have a power-packed group here with me today, three women with experiences and education and all kinds of things, so I'm really pleased to introduce my three guests, Megan Cleland, who is kind of my honorary co-host because she's with Indivisible and has been with us. Good evening, Megan.
Hi.
Everything going good with Indivisible?
Sure.
We'll go into it later. And Roberta Hunt.
Hi.
And she is from PSU as an assistant professor there with all kinds of things to share with us tonight. And Amy Copeland?
Copeland.
And she has done some PhD work around workers' rights and wages and livable lifestyle. So the three of them are going to have a great conversation. And I'll start it off by asking Roberta to tell us a little bit about your background, where you've come from, and all those things listed on your profile at PSU.
Hi, thank you. Thank you, Lane, for having me. And Megan?
Hi.
Thank you. So I am here. I teach at Portland State in Child, Youth, and Family Studies. And my doctorate was on Black Women in Construction in Peace and Conflict Studies. And so I think what brought me here today was our film, a film that I co-produced with Don Jones Redstone called Sista and the Brotherhood, which was a 20-minute short film about the experience of a Black tradeswoman. It is a fictional short film based on my doctorate research in interviewing Black women who've been in the trades for 6 to 30 plus years.
Right. And it was a very charming film and very truthful, I'm sure. And that's where I first ran into you, was watching that film. And Amy was also at the same conference, the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association conference this year. And Amy also was watching your film. And you made a presentation, too. Tell me about that.
Sure. And I think I was fangirling out a little bit earlier because I'm really excited to meet Roberta because I really love your work. And I think it's really great and important, really important work. My research is on labor organizing. I helped organize the Pacific Northwest Labor History Conference, a really fun conference, brought a lot of folks together. My background is actually in sustainable food systems, and I have done a lot of work doing food and farm education, and through that work sort of started feeling a little bit jaded by the sustainability movement and sort of this notion that we can sort of vote with our forks for sustainability and that we can sort of buy our way to sustainability and social justice. And so, and also starting to realize that a lot of the workers in our food system are highly exploited, and even workers in the quote unquote sustainable food systems. And so set my sights on doing research looking at workers who are organizing to sort of push back against that sustainability discourse and expose those kind of contradictions. And did my research on the Burgerville Workers Union was my main case study. So looking at how those folks were successful in organizing in an industry that's really challenging to organize, lots of poor folks, lots of women, people of color working in that industry. It's a very difficult industry to organize in because of the turnover. And so looking at how the BVW succeeded in that, because they made history, is pretty cool.
How would we know if Burgerville is an organized Burgerville here in town?
Well, there are five shops that that filed for and overwhelmingly won their elections. There's 42 Burgerville locations across the state. So I think, but there's still actually an active boycott against Burgerville right now. So workers are, trying to maintain that boycott until Burgerville actually bargains in good faith. They have come to the table with very meager, pathetic, and just downright disrespectful bargaining habits. They came to the table with a 13-cent raise, and that is certainly not enough to lift workers out of poverty, and it's not respectful. And so workers are looking for dignity on the job and living wages and accessible healthcare and affordable healthcare and lots of other things that they deserve.
Right. Well, Megan, you're up.
Oh, hi.
How's Indivisible doing this evening and, we are, you know, in the
busy
future?
We are very busy. For some background, I'm part of a group in Oregon that started right after the election in 2016 and just started organizing people to learn about their government, engage with their members of Congress, and push them to be more progressive, or at the very least kind of stop the damage that we saw coming from Donald Trump that he had kind of promised throughout the entire election that he was going to do. And then right now, today is the first day of the House recess. It says recess, but really it's a district work period, which means they're all back here. We have the Senate starts on Monday next, on August 3rd. They'll be back. So Senator Merkley, Senator Wyden will have town halls all over Oregon. We have five members of in our federal delegation. And they'll all be back here. And right now, we're pushing for an impeachment inquiry. And that's really been our driving kind of message going forward. So it's very busy.
Very busy. And that's how is the statewide involvement with Indivisible going?
So there are a ton of groups. So we have Portland alone, just in Multnomah County, there are 17 Indivisible groups. They all do various things. Some work on a state level, some work at the very, very local, like municipal level. OR2, which is basically everything east of the Cascades, they have a lot of active groups that that reach out and engage with Greg Walden, who, I will say, before the 2018 election, before Indivisible was really a thing, we've been pushing Greg Walden to have town halls, and he now has held the most town halls of any House member in the country, and that's all thanks to Indivisible groups just kind of bird-dogging him and saying, we want you, you have to listen to us. So this kind of engagement is really, we're seeing it work. We're seeing it, the engagement work with Peter DeFazio, who's in District 4, which is like Eugene out to the coast area, which is a pretty purple, kind of not known for being particularly progressive, but after a lot of push from Indivisible groups, he now has come out in favor of an impeachment inquiry, and he hasn't said anything before that. So it's a lot of work. It's a lot of people organizing and giving up a lot of free time, but it works.
And it's pretty much free of charge. There's a small fundraiser going on now. Nationally,
Well, nationally. So the thing about Indivisible is that it's completely bottom up. So
right.
when you start an Indivisible group, all you really need to do is promise that you're going to use your time effectively to engage with your members of Congress, meaning anyone else does not care what you think. Only the people that you are going to vote into office care what you think. And your voice matters. You have a voice. You should use it. And national kind of they raise money and they give us tools for different pieces of legislation if we want to do a push and organize people around it to call constituents in other places, other states, and have them call their members of a Congress. But we personally don't. We're completely nonprofit. We're not even technically, you know, incorporated. We're just like a bunch of people who care.
And once in a while, you sell T-shirts.
Every once in a while, yeah, yes.
Now, your work is notable. And more and more people are becoming familiar with it. You want to let me know how you can be contacted online?
Yeah, so our website is indivisibleor.org. We're on Twitter. Just search Indivisible Oregon. You can find the national stuff at indivisible.org. And most of that stuff will be there. There are resources all on our page. So.
And when she says stuff, she means
a lot of stuff.
Educational information yeah. that a lot of different volunteers have mm-hmm. compiled and put on the website.
Yeah,
right?
and we have a whole, you know, we've been doing five actions a week for 2.5 years, which is insane now that I think about it. But it's all on our website. It's all archived. And so if you, for some reason, really care about, you know, a particular issue, you can search that issue and find all of the research we've done, scripts to find your members, to call your members of Congress, what our members of Congress have done about that issue. And so it's a really great resource, even if you're not concentrating on what Indivisible National or your local group is doing.
And have you two heard about, is it Trump Tuesdays? Is it still called that?
It is now Indivisible Tuesday.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. And that's where people show up at the...
Yep,
the offices.
Yep, twice a month. We do one at Senator Merkley's office, one at Senator Wyden's office in the Portland area. There are other groups around the state that do other types of engagement with their members of Congress. We urge that if you can't come on a Tuesday, it's every Tuesday afternoon, we go and meet with the staff and bring an ask, and we generally have a pretty decent crowd. But if you can't go to one of those, town halls are the number one best place to engage with your member of Congress. They pay attention. We've heard they pay attention, and they've been urging us to try to get as many people as possible to those places because that's how they can take stuff back to Washington and say, look, we have to move on this. This is how much energy is behind whatever kind of topic it is. Yeah.
In the beginning of their work, they had those signs that you held up, agree, disagree.
Oh, yeah, we still have those.
That was kind of their logo at the town halls. Do you guys have any questions for Megan? Do you know? Did you know about Indivisible before we came in here today?
No, I didn't. And so for me, I'm just really excited to hear about this work and ways that people can get involved locally. I think a lot of people feel like, what can I do?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very concentrated, issue-focused mm-hmm. approach that's really exciting.
Mm-hmm. Well, and one of the great things about us and kept us nimble is that we're not, you know, Medicare for All is a group that does stuff on Medicare for All, but we're allowed to be really nimble, and we don't have a particular, like, one issue we focus on. We did a ton of work around the ACA, nonstop, because they kept trying to repeal it. But we, you know, immigration, we do stuff on ethics laws, like basically anything that the government, the administration that's in office now is trying to strip back. We can learn about it, research it, and say, call your members of Congress. And I've stopped quite a few things that people didn't think that no one was paying attention to. And we just said, well, that's silly. Let's call them. And it works. It's like kind of ridiculous how simple, but also brilliant.
There strategy, seems to yeah. be a bit of a gap between that kind of involvement and already kind of, you know, union organizing and union involvement in politics. Those two things have not met. So that's one of my goals here, is to make sure that their message gets out to the union people and folks that you dealt with. Amy, I would like you to go into some of those interviews you did for your PhD work at Portland State. Amy Copeland.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I did over 2 years of participant observation, organizing with folks, helping folks with sort of shop floor actions, bringing petitions to their management, And then also just helping plan events and pickets. I hope folks have seen witnessed pickets. The BBW does a great job, makes a party out of it. And I hope no one listening now has crossed those picket lines.
It's the number one rule. That's what I was taught when I was young. You don't ever cross a picket line.
I actually just came across an article today about the National Labor Relations Board trying to ban Scabby the rat, who is this like gigantic inflatable rat.
Very offensive rat.
Scab for people. I know what it is, I swear. But a scab is
somebody who crosses the line.
A picket line.
And usually goes to work, which is even, you know, they're not just crossing to get their hamburger. They're actually crossing to go to work.
Totally.
So both of those are considered not good.
Yeah. So this giant inflatable rat has become the newest target of the National Labor Relations Board, so I don't quite understand. It's just a balloon, but I guess it has a lot of power. So I did about 50 interviews with workers across my four cases, mostly the Burgerville workers, and you know, I heard a lot of things from folks. Folks are really struggling to make ends meet. Folks are working really hard, and that, you know, sort of inspired folks to push back. I think folks were also really inspired by the Fight for 15 organizing that
$15 an hour.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that work was sort of spearheaded by SEIU. And, you know, it was really inspiring to see fast food workers go on strike and show their power in a way that they never had before. And I was telling y'all earlier that the SEIU's original rallying cry was 15 and a union, and they sort of didn't keep up that second half of their promise to organize unions for workers. And so I think the BVW in some ways sees themselves as Fight for 15 2.0, and has been successful in organizing the first union for fast food workers in over 40 years.
Right.
Were these interviews that you did, were they all kind of local in and around Portland, or is this kind of outside of that? I know Burgerville is really only in Oregon, right?
It's 42 locations in Oregon and Washington. Most of my interviews were done with workers from Portland and sort of the Portland metro area and Vancouver. But there's locations across the state. I'm sorry, what was your...
That was basically my question of whether or not it was in around Portland. Yeah.
Yeah, and so I interviewed Burgerville workers, and then I also interviewed folks at three other that had worked at three other establishments and done organizing campaigns in the past. One of those was New Seasons, which is sort of the epitome of sustainability branding in Portland. The other was Grand Central Bakery. Folks don't know there was an organizing campaign there a few years back. And then another was at Portobello, which was a vegan restaurant that has actually closed down. So I interviewed workers who were organizing at those restaurants or those institutions, and they were very much, you know, this kind of sustainability veneer. Masks the fact that there are folks being exploited that are working there, and folks are up against some really terrible working conditions. So I think that it's important that we support workers who are organizing to build power in their workplaces.
And Roberta, your topic that you discussed with me before we came in had to do with blending several things in areas that are of importance to you too. Why don't you go into some of those areas and how you see them blending? Like the thing that you're talking about here. You want me to give you some clues?
So well it's just we talked about a few things.
Yes, we did talk about a number of things.
So but I think what you're referring to is so with this short film, it was a way of integrating research into a narrative short and engaging a wider audience. With Bonnie Ratner, I worked to turn my dissertation into a play called My Walk Has Never Been Average that showcased the narratives of the women that I interviewed. And with both the play and this short film, Sista and the Brotherhood, with Dawn Jones Redstone, we've been able to have broader conversations in the both in well, on the West Coast, with though the film, because it's a short film, has traveled internationally and has been watched by thousands of people. Plays, not so much, right, because of the amount of work of putting on a play and whatnot. But I have been thinking a lot more about how can research be consumed by wider audiences and engage the subjects, right, the subject matter. So, for example, the film Sista and the Brotherhood has been used. It's been used by unions. It's been used by apprenticeship training centers. It's facilitated a lot of conversations within different trades about the conditions of women and women of color and black women, and specifically in their industry. It's also been shown at, you know, kind of film festivals and more traditional venues, but also in with architecture groups and labor history groups and different professions that are male dominant and non-traditional for women.
Yes, and you also, you teach some classes at Portland State also, right?
Yeah.
But is it in a different area, or do you incorporate some other things into your classes?
Well, so I would say me and my beloved profession, I am eclectic. So my departments have been conflict resolution, Black studies, women, gender, and sexuality studies, and now child, youth, and family studies. And I do work with Madison High School with senior inquiry, which is a part of university studies. So like all academics, I find a job.
Or not. You make a job. And how are you doing on the job front?
Well, I'm looking for a job.
Uh-huh. Would you like to volunteer? We have plenty of opportunities.
I need a paid job. But I really respect and like admire the way that you've created this product that you can disseminate and engage people in a really important way. I think something I've struggled with and that I'm starting to think about is how can I turn my research into a tool that can be useful to not only the populations that I studied, like the folks that I organized with, but how can that be turned into a tool that can help with movement building, and how can I share the lessons that I learned from the BVW with wider audiences? And I think, you know, I've seen your film twice, and I feel like it's so impactful, and it's this sort of like portable thing, this tangible thing that anybody can watch and just, you know, be impacted by and learn so much from. And I think the fact that it's not this like stodgy kind of like documentary or something, I think makes it really compelling.
Yeah, it's very creative.
Yeah.
Have you seen it, Meg?
I have not seen it. I was just going to ask a question. Is it, you'd mentioned before that you'd shown it to unions and stuff. Is this kind of facilitating a conversation around racism and sexism, like kind of in that power structure? Is that what we're...
It depends on how it is used, right? So gotcha. Depending on who has brought the film in, they're kind of bringing it in with a certain outcome in mind.
Right.
And I think it's been a way to have direct conversations and indirect conversations about racism and sexism in the industry and in a particular field. Mm-hmm. I think it's also supported a lot of truth-telling. And I think about one union that shared the film, and they invited women within their union to watch the film, and that men were in the room. And for the women, they routinely, what I've heard when women watch the film is, I haven't had all of those things happen to me in one day, right? It was a very bad day. But I, over my career, all of those things have happened in some way, shape, or form. And I think, you know, I think unions and I appreciate the work that construction unions are doing to bring more women and people of color into the industry. And it's not enough. Mm-hmm. And what we see in our current political climate mm-hmm. is that advances can easily be eroded very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so the lack of, I think real, 2020, right? So it was like mm-hmm. the idea of 20% women in the trades by 2020. We're not there. but we could be, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And but it requires such a level of commitment. And for Black women to succeed in the trades and for other women of color, it can't just be about women, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. It has to be about addressing racism. Mm-hmm. And of course, there needs to be real addressing of xenophobia, of homophobia mm-hmm. in the industry. I mean, what I think about largely is this is economic, right? This is mm-hmm. the trades, first of all, does not have the workforce to meet the demand
right.
for our growing city and our growing region. And so to make it work, all people who come in need to stay.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
And people will stay if they feel like they can.
Right. Yeah.
And a lot of that is addressing cultural and structural barriers.
Mm-hmm. And at least getting people to recognize that there are cultural and structural barriers.
Well, and the economics, we're talking about two different, almost extremes, the lower end workers mm-hmm. at food service, and then those jobs are high yeah. paid mm-hmm. and really sustainable. They can actually yeah. live on those wages.
They can, but, and what I think about from women that I interviewed was they said, $50 an hour is great, except if you get fired or let go or just don't get mm-hmm. hired again, the bills still mm-hmm. keep coming. Mm-hmm. So $50 an hour that allows you to get a long-term sustainable position with a pension, that's really more of what we're working mm-hmm. towards, not a job here and a job there and nothing mm-hmm. in between.
Mm-hmm. Like being an actor or one of those kind of jobs or a yeah. student.
Right? Yeah, I mean, that's something I found in my research too, is that, a similar phenomenon, which is that, yes, workers need and want a raise, but that is not automatically going to make their lives great. Like they need a raise, but they also need to not be sexually harassed in the workplace and discriminated against. They need affordable health insurance. They need respect and dignity on the job. And so I think a lot of issues around labor tend to just get coalesced around wages, and like that if we can just raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, or if we can just get a raise, that everything's going to be fine. And that's not the case. So right. we need a more holistic, and I think it's really about sort of like building worker power in the workplace so that they can push for all the things they need, not just a raise, so that they can build power to make those kind of changes in their workplace.
Well, I'd really like to see a workforce that would channel into Indivisible that's around labor yeah, issues open. Because yeah. the labor issues are so mm-hmm. similar to mm-hmm. the groundwork you're doing.
Yeah, and there's a bunch of stuff on the federal, like the Janus decision that the Supreme Court was devastating. We just got a new labor secretary, because the first one that was nominated had to withdraw because of abuse allegations. And then Acosta, who was the most recent labor secretary, had some issues in his past. So we are on a third labor secretary. I don't know if anything's going to happen forward, but I know that they will do everything to move us backwards. That's mm-hmm. kind of their MO. And so anything that we are open, we're ready to kind of work with people we love. We have a lot of people on the ground who just want to know how they can help and where their energy is going to be the most effective. And you can email us at resist@indivisibleor.org, and we can figure out some way to work.
I thank the three of you for being here this
evening.
I have
more questions.
Go right ahead. You make it fast.
I do. I have one question. Amy, so did you find when you're organizing or you're interviewing Burgerville employees, what was kind of the way to get them? I know, like, coming from the, working poor background, it was really hard to organize because you have to strike. and like we would have not afforded our house, like we would have been evicted. Mm-hmm. And how they kind of even with Burgerville, who kind of claims to be a more like not McDonald's as far as being progressive, how the workers move from needing their money and out in the picket line. Like,
that's
is there
a really big question. We probably don't have time for me to answer it, but I think I'll just say that they have done a lot of organizing mm-hmm. around mutual aid programs, actually right. okay. in part inspired by the Black Panther mm-hmm. Party. So assisting workers with food and childcare and subsidized mm-hmm. transportation. I think those types of meeting folks' basic needs mm-hmm. is really critical to yeah. getting folks involved in
really
organizing.
Necessary. Absolutely. I think a lot of people don't think about it. They're like, oh, just organize and strike and
it's hard. It's really
lose your car, lose your apartment, lose yeah. your house. Yeah. Yeah. Did you have one more quick one?
No, we've got,
okay.
Good.
We made it to 6:30. I want you guys to come back again sometime. I know you've been on the radio before because you're both very, all three of you are very charming and educated. So we're going to close out with a happy birthday song from Ann Feeney, who's has a July birthday. And she is an activist songster, and she wrote this song.
Listen up. We've got a war zone here today right in our heartland. And across the USA, these multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true. But they've declared a war on us. Fight back, it's up to you. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots.
Like the KBOO Community Radio Facebook page. Find KBOO Community Radio on Facebook and like our page and have events, ticket giveaways.